When we usually think about bleeding edge technology, we picture something incredibly delicate, like a prototype sitting in this pristine, sterile lab.
Yeah, surrounded by scientists holding their collective breath, just praying the thing turns on.
Exactly. Hoping it doesn't catch fire or melt down on the desk. You treat it with kid gloves because it's an experiment,
Right, the classic fragile innovation phase. It's a proof of concept. It's definitely not a household appliance.
But there is this very specific, almost invisible threshold that every successful technology eventually crosses. It's the moment the magic just becomes mundane.
When the bleeding edge hardens into everyday infrastructure.
Yes, exactly that. And we're looking at a stack of tech dispatches from August 9th, 2026. And our mission for this deep dive is to hunt for those exact transition moments.
We want to find the friction, the philosophical battles, and the massive security holes that open up when you try to take the impossible and mass produce it.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the sheer industrialization of extreme hardware. I mean, just look at this dispatch from Vandenberg Space Force Base on Thursday morning, August 8th.
Oh, yeah, the Falcon 9 launch with the 24 Starlink satellites.
Right. When you look at the raw data on that launch, the aerospace industry has crossed a threshold that would have sounded like, I don't know, science fiction a decade ago.
Completely. The numbers are just staggering.
Yeah, this was SpaceX's 50th launch from the West Coast in 2026 alone. But it's the specific rocket that genuinely blew my mind.
Booster B1633.
Right. The booster used in this mission flew to space for the 34th time.
34 times.
I mean, after deploying its payload, it came right back through the atmosphere and basically parallel parked itself on a drone ship in the ocean.
Which is incredible when you think about the
I was
physics.
trying to wrap my head around it. It's literally like driving a used car for decades, except your morning commute involves strapping yourself to a controlled explosion.
Yeah, and enduring the brutal thermal stress of atmospheric reentry.
Right, and doing it over and over again.
What's fascinating here is that thermal stress is the key differentiator. For decades, the entire aerospace paradigm was built on single-use vehicles.
Because the sheer violence of leaving the atmosphere just tears metal apart.
Exactly. Rockets were bespoke, multi-billion-dollar singular events. But a booster surviving 34 trips? That proves material science and reusability are no longer experiments.
They're the standard.
Yeah, space travel is completely out of the testing phase. It is purely, unapologetically industrial now. We are watching an assembly line that stretches into low Earth orbit.
And the scale they're operating at really reinforces that assembly line visual. I mean, if you factor in their Florida launches, they are executing over 120 launches a year.
It's massive. They have more than 6,000 active Starlink satellites in orbit right now.
Servicing over 4 million users, all marching toward this final goal of 42,000 satellites.
And Vandenberg plays a really specific role in that network. The California coast is, well, it's the ideal geographical launch pad for putting satellites into polar, high-inclination orbits.
Ah, so that's what allows them to blanket the globe and reach the remote latitudes.
Right, rather than just hugging the equator.
So they've clearly mastered the macro scale, but taking bleeding edge hardware and trying to mass produce it is just as difficult on the micro scale.
Oh, absolutely.
And that becomes incredibly obvious when we look at the latest leak out of Apple's supply chain. Chinese accessory manufacturers are already making camera protectors for the iPhone Ultra.
Which totally gives away Apple's hand ahead of their September event.
Right. It's their long-anticipated entry into the foldable market. And they're entering it with a record-breaking predicted price tag of $2,499.
That is steep.
It's very steep. But the detail that really caught my eye wasn't the price, it was the aesthetics. They're only offering it in two colors.
Classic silver and that bold ocean depths, dark blue.
Yeah. If you look at standard iPhones, they come in a rainbow of options, right? Limiting a Halo product to just two colors feels incredibly restrictive.
Well, it's calculated restriction. Apple is famously conservative when it comes to adopting new form factors.
Mostly because their mass production standards are so unforgiving, right?
Exactly. Think about the physical mechanics of a foldable phone. You aren't just stamping a piece of aluminum and gluing glass to it.
Right, you're engineering a microscopic hinge mechanism.
A hinge that has to keep out microscopic dust particles while simultaneously applying perfect tension to a layer of OLED material.
Material that has to bend like hundreds of thousands of times without creasing or snapping.
Exactly. So by limiting the aesthetic variables, they are stripping complexity out of the manufacturing process.
Oh, I see. If you only have to anodize two colors of metal, you reduce the number of production lines.
Right, which makes quality control significantly tighter on a device that is already, frankly, a logistical nightmare to build.
That makes total sense.
And at $2,499, this is not a Pro Max replacement designed to sell 100 million units. Our analyst source highlights that this is a statement piece.
A luxury item.
Yeah, aimed at early adopters willing to pay a premium to basically beta test Apple's first foray into folding glass. It's hardware pushing the boundaries of what can physically be manufactured at scale.
But, you know, pushing those physical boundaries, the rocket fuselage, the folding glass, that's really only half the battle.
Right, the outer shell is just the beginning.
Exactly. The real bottleneck for the next generation of tech is the microscopic silicon brain sitting inside it. And AMD just made a move that totally flips the script on how we process artificial intelligence.
Yeah, their acquisition of Talist, the Toronto-based startup, this is easily the most disruptive development in our entire stack of sources.
The mechanics of it are wild. So traditional AI processing works by storing an AI model in memory, like RAM or a GPU's memory bank.
Right. And then the processor has to constantly reach into that memory, grab the data, bring it back, perform a calculation, and send the result back.
But Talus throws that entire architecture in the trash. They hard code the AI model's weights directly into the physical silicon structure of the chip itself.
The software literally becomes the hardware.
Right. But when I read that, it sounded like a massive step backward. Let me test an analogy on you.
Okay, let's hear it.
A traditional GPU is like an iPad. You can download a sci-fi book, read it, delete it, and download a cookbook. It's infinitely flexible.
Sure.
But this Talus chip sounds like a printed hardcover book. Once those words are printed onto the page or etched into the silicon, you can't change the story.
You can't update it.
Right. You can't update the model without throwing the chip away and buying a new one. Why would anyone intentionally lock themselves into a hardware dead end like that?
Well, the printed book analogy captures the limitation perfectly, but it misses the massive hidden cost of the iPad.
The hidden cost.
Yeah. Using a digital tablet requires a battery, an operating system, background processes, and time to load the file into the processor's active memory.
Okay, yeah.
In computer science, that constant shuffling of data between the memory and the processor is called the von Neumann bottleneck.
The von Neumann bottleneck.
Right. Fetching the AI model weights from RAM and dragging them across the motherboard to the processor is a massive drain on both time and energy.
Mm-hmm.
It literally takes more power to move the data than it does to actually perform the math.
Oh, wow. So the commute is killing the efficiency.
Exactly. By hard coding the model directly into the silicon, that commute drops to zero. Access is instantaneous.
And the energy consumption plummets.
Yes. You give up the ability to update the chip, but you gain hyper-efficiency. Now look at where this is applied.
You aren't using this to train the next ChatGPT-2.
No, this is for AI inference, running a completed, established model.
Okay, so if you're manufacturing, say, a million smart home cameras with facial recognition, you don't need a massive, power-hungry, updatable GPU.
Exactly. You need a chip that recognizes a face instantly while running on practically zero electricity.
You embed a highly specific printed book into every doorbell, toaster, and security camera.
Yes. And that plays perfectly into the broader market dynamics. NVIDIA currently holds a total monopoly over the general GPU market.
But the inference market, the business of just running the models in the real world, that's projected to hit $50 billion by 2030.
Right. So AMD is realizing they don't have to fight NVIDIA on flexibility. They can outflank them on raw, hard-coded efficiency.
It's a brilliant hardware pivot.
It really is.
But, you know, as these hard-coded, hyper-efficient systems become embedded into everything around us, the software layers connecting them are becoming terrifyingly vulnerable.
Yeah, that transition is rough.
And that became glaringly obvious in the Black Hat 2026 presentation by security researcher Gareth Heise.
Oh, the CSS presentation.
Yes. He demonstrated how attackers are completely weaponizing CSS.
This presentation turns conventional security wisdom completely upside down.
Nah.
Specifically because it exploits a technology we all just assume is harmless.
I was genuinely confused reading this. CSS stands for Cascading Style Sheets. For anyone who has ever built a basic website, CSS is basically just the interior decorator of the internet.
Right. It changes the background color, rounds the corners of a button.
Exactly. It just makes the font look pretty. So how on earth does an email font steal a password?
Well, attackers are banking on that exact misconception. We assume CSS is just a coat of paint, so email clients let it right through their security filters.
But it's not just a coat of paint.
No. Heise demonstrated that CSS fundamentally manipulates the user interface. He showed exploits bypassing the security boundaries of major webmail services like Gmail, Outlook, ProtonMail, Yahoo.
But how does it physically extract a password? The source detailed this Outlook and Firefox exploit that honestly sounded like magic.
It's all about visual manipulation. Imagine you open an HTML email from an unknown sender. The email contains a malicious CSS payload.
Okay.
When that renders in your browser, the CSS code doesn't just change the font. It draws a flawless, pixel-perfect Microsoft login box and physically layers it directly on top of your actual inbox.
Wait, so I'm reading my email and this login prompt just pops up over my messages.
Yes.
And I would naturally assume my session just timed out.
Exactly. You type in your password, but the CSS has manipulated the input fields.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it intercepts your keystrokes and silently routes them to the attacker's server, all while you think you're just logging back into Microsoft.
That is devious. It's a seamless illusion.
Very seamless.
But he also talked about extracting tokens from the DOM. What is the DOM, and how does CSS steal from it?
So the DOM, or Document Object Model, is essentially the structural skeleton of a web page.
Okay, the skeleton.
Right. It holds all the underlying data that makes the page function, including authentication tokens. Those are the invisible digital keys that keep you logged into sites like Medium or Gmail.
So you don't have to sign in every single time you click a link.
Exactly. Hayes showed how CSS attribute selectors can scour that skeleton, find the digital key, and fire off background requests to an external server.
So the attacker steals your session without ever even asking for a password.
Yep, it's entirely invisible to the user.
And the most disturbing part of the presentation involved spoofing AI assistants.
Oh, this part was wild.
Right. Think about Gmail's smart reply feature, which reads your incoming emails and suggests those three quick responses at the bottom.
Yeah.
The presentation showed how CSS can hide the actual malicious text of an email from your human eyes, maybe by making the font transparent or pushing it way off screen.
But it displays it perfectly to the AI bot reading the underlying code.
Exactly. The AI gets tricked into suggesting compromising or dangerous replies based on an invisible conversation you can't even see.
The AI is essentially hallucinating based on manipulated formatting.
That is terrifying.
Microsoft and Google are currently racing to patch how they handle CSS, but until the architecture changes, our source has very firm, actionable advice.
Which is?
Avoid opening HTML emails from unknown senders entirely. Switch to plain text mode if something looks even a little suspicious.
Plain text strips out all the formatting, right?
Exactly. Neutralizes the CSS. Also, never, ever use a login field that appears inside an email interface. If your session expires, open a brand new tab and navigate to the site yourself.
And obviously, turn on two-factor authentication.
Yes. Even if a fake CSS overlay captures your password, the attacker still doesn't have the rotating code on your phone.
So defense in depth is really your only safety net here.
It absolutely is.
And that concept of defense in depth is critical, especially when we move from personal email to massive corporate networks.
Right, because the stakes get so much higher.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because while CSS targets the individual, there is a vulnerability right now targeting the absolute edge of organizational infrastructure. I'm talking about the Progress Kemp Loadmaster vulnerability.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, CVE-2026-80037 is a huge deal. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISE, just added this to their known exploited vulnerabilities catalog on August 7th.
And the metrics on this are incredibly grim. It's a command injection flaw, and it was given a CVSS score of 9.6.
Right.
For anyone not living in cybersecurity acronyms, the Common Vulnerability Scoring System is basically the DEFCON level for software bugs, measured on a 10-point scale. A 9.6 means the alarm bells are deafening.
And hackers know it. The source notes 792 active exploitation attempts already.
Wow.
They're actively scanning the internet, basically jiggling digital doorknobs to see who forgot to patch their systems.
A 9.6 score on a load balancer is a true nightmare scenario for a network administrator, isn't it?
It is, primarily because of where a load balancer physically sits on the network.
It sits right at the edge, right. Let me try to break down why this is so dangerous.
Go for it.
The Loadmaster is the very first piece of hardware that external traffic hits when it tries to enter a company's network. And the dispatch says its primary job is to terminate HTTPS traffic.
Right.
So if HTTPS is encrypted, secure traffic, is terminating it basically like a bouncer at a club checking IDs and making everyone take off their masks before they can walk into the actual building?
That's a really accurate way to look at it, actually. When data travels across the open internet, it's scrambled and encrypted. If someone intercepts it, it just looks like gibberish.
Right, to protect it in transit.
Exactly. But the internal servers inside the company, they can't process gibberish. So the loadmaster holds the decryption keys.
And the bouncer has the guest list.
Yes. It terminates the secure connection, decrypts the traffic to inspect it, and then balances the load by routing that now readable data to the correct internal server.
Which means if a hacker exploits that 9.6 command injection flaw.
They compromise the bouncer. A command injection flaw allows an attacker to inject their own unauthorized commands into the device's operating system.
Oh, man.
Yeah, if they take over the loadmaster, they gain access to all of that decrypted internal traffic flowing into the company.
They can just execute a man-in-the-middle attack.
Sitting silently and reading everything. They can even steal the organization's TLS certificates.
And TLS certificates are the digital passports that prove a website or server is who they claim to be. If you steal those, you can impersonate the company entirely.
Exactly.
No wonder CISA gave all federal agencies a strict, non-negotiable deadline of August 28th to patch the vulnerability.
Patch it or physically disconnect the devices from the network. Private organizations need to treat that deadline with the exact same severity. The patch is available, so the failure point now is purely human delay.
It really highlights this exhausting dynamic in cybersecurity.
It really does.
Attackers find a clever way to break the rules. Defenders race to patch the code and write new rules. It's just an endless loop.
A constant game of cat and mouse.
Right. But what happens when the community itself fundamentally disagrees on what the rules should be in the first place? That brings us to our final dispatch, the philosophical civil war happening inside the Bitcoin code.
The chain split at block 961,632. This is a fascinating human problem.
Let's set the stage for this. On August 8th, the Bitcoin blockchain literally split into two competing versions. A mining pool known as the Roughnecks initiated the split over a proposal called BIP-110.
Right.
From my understanding, BIP-110 is a strict rule designed to ban arbitrary data from the blockchain. Over the last few years, people have been using Bitcoin to store NFTs, images, and non-financial data.
Yeah, the Ordinals trend.
Exactly. The Roughnecks want to block all of that and force Bitcoin to be strictly a financial ledger.
They want to purge the network of what they consider spam.
But the broader network completely ignored them. I'm looking at the mining statistics here, and the math just doesn't support the rebellion.
Not at all.
The Roughnecks mined a couple of blocks on their new BIP-110 chain, but the main chain kept moving and is already 18 blocks ahead.
Yeah, the market spoke.
The mining difficulty on the main chain is sitting at an all-time high of 127.48 trillion. So it has the backing of massive global computing power.
And BIP-110.
BIP-110 only has 2.6% support from the network's miners. You need at least 55% to force a successful fork. So if they know they only have 2.6% support, why even pull the trigger? Isn't this just a digital temper tantrum that's mathematically doomed to fail?
Well, mathematically, yes. History dictates this fork will wither and die. Forks with less than 10% support don't survive because cryptocurrency exchanges refuse to list them.
And wallet developers won't build infrastructure for our minority chain, right?
Exactly. But you have to look at the underlying motivation here. In decentralized technology, code is philosophy.
Code is philosophy.
Yes, the Roughnecks didn't fork to take over the network. They forked to draw an ideological line in the sand.
So it's essentially a protest vote written in code?
Exactly. This represents a fundamental schism in how humans value block space. One faction believes a blockchain should be a pure, pristine payment system.
A decentralized global bank where every single byte of data is dedicated to the transfer of financial value.
Right. But the opposing faction believes a blockchain is a completely open, censorship-resistant public data platform.
And anyone should be able to store anything, art, documents, whatever, as long as they're willing to pay the transaction fee.
Yes. It's a debate over the very definition of the tool. And code cannot resolve a debate about human values.
That's a great point. You can write an algorithm to verify a transaction perfectly, but you can't write an algorithm to determine what a transaction ought to be used for.
That is the crux of the issue. It's a deeply human problem embedded into a really rigid technical framework.
Which is fascinating to watch play out. But just to reassure anyone listening who might hold digital assets, our expert source is completely unambiguous about this. Your Bitcoin is not at risk from this miner fork.
Not at all.
As long as you stick to reputable digital wallets and don't try to manually interact with the minority BIP-110 chain, you don't have to take any action. Your wallet will seamlessly follow the main chain, secured by that 127 trillion mining difficulty.
The consensus protocol protects the passive user.
What a profound journey this stack of sources has taken us on today. We started by looking at SpaceX and Apple, watching them push the absolute physical limits of industrialization, from landing rocket boosters 34 times to engineering flooding glass screens for our pockets.
Yeah, the macro and the micro.
And then we examine the microscopic limits, with AMD hard coding AI intelligence directly into silicon to eliminate the von Neumann bottleneck.
The software becoming hardware.
Right. We uncovered the invisible software wars, where attackers use basic CSS formatting to forge login screens and compromise the LoadMaster load balancers that act as the bouncers for our corporate networks.
And finally, we saw how philosophical disagreements over human values literally split the Bitcoin blockchain in two. You know, thinking about all this, we discussed AMD hard coding AI directly into physical silicon chips to make them hyper efficient, meaning they completely lose the ability to be updated with a software patch.
Right, the printed book analogy.
Yeah. And we also just discussed how hackers are constantly finding brilliant, unforeseen ways to compromise complex systems using things as innocent as CSS formatting or edge network load balancers.
Right.
So what happens when a critical zero-day vulnerability is discovered in the AI logic of a hard-coded tileless chip?
Oh, wow.
You can't just push an over-the-air software update to a printed silicon brain. To fix that security hole, you would have to physically recall, rip out, and replace billions of compromised chips permanently embedded in security cameras, smart home hubs, and critical infrastructure all over the globe.
That would be a logistical nightmare.
Exactly. The moment the magic becomes mundane, the stakes become infinitely higher.
That is a terrifying thought to leave on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the technology you interact with every day, and we'll see you next time.